you're right. We should talk about Robin Hood. Specifically, in this case, Robin Hood and the Pirates. So for our Splitting Arrows episode, we're jumping back in time a little bit. We had been entering the 1970s in our Splitting Arrow series, but I've been introduced to a whole slate of European Robin Hood movies. So we're jumping all the way back to 1960 for this one. Robin Hood, A.E. Pirati, Robin Hood and the Pirates, an Italian film. It was directed by Giorgio Simonelli and stars Lex Barker. We'll get a little bit into our cast and crew in a moment. I am joined this week with Richard Hopkins Lutz yet again, and also my brother Theodore, a.k.a. Theo Papke. How are you doing, guys?
Doing good. Looking forward to this. I have no idea what to expect.
Yeah, I would be shocked if either of you had seen this movie before.
I have seen a lot of it, of Italian, I'm going to use the word schlock films, but you know, the Italians were doing a lot of like kind of quick cash grab films.
We got the spaghetti westerns.
Spaghetti westerns, the Hercules films. All of the Hercules films were, you know, quick cash grabs.
But I've seen a few great spaghetti westerns, and so I'm hoping it'll be like that, but with pirates? Robin Hood? What?
So you may have seen some of the spaghetti westerns, because they're actually good and well-remembered, and a lot of them starred American stars like Clint Eastwood. So they've gotten a lot of replay in the U.S. Rick and I, being a little bit older, would sometimes come across like the crazy, what is it, like Hercules versus the Venusians or whatever it was, kind of movies and like late night film kind of things back in the wild pre-internet days.
Yeah, back on like late night movies for anybody old enough to remember those.
Immense and immortal was the strength of Hercules. Savage and sensual was the world of Hercules. Lavishly produced amid pagan palaces on Mediterranean shores, where Hercules lived, loved, and awed his fellow men.
Yeah, there was like, I'm literally looking at a list. They had great titles: Hercules and the Captive Women, Hercules in the Haunted World, Ulysses Against Hercules. They're the class of movie where they're not good, but they're fun. Usually, not always. And sometimes they're just bad.
Looking at the filmography of the writers and director for this movie, they have a number of things that are of that vein. I didn't see any of the Hercules films specifically, but it is along those lines.
But they were basically kind of like Hammer films were back in the day, where like they weren't necessarily the greatest quality films, but they were there to grab money. They didn't have big budgets. And it's important to remember that like a lot of the really famous spaghetti westerns, you know, that were all shot in Spain and Northern Italy, like they're the same way. They were not produced on big budgets. You know, they were just meant to cash in on a popularity of something. And like today we'll look back at them very fondly, at least on the spaghetti westerns. Hercules not so much, because it doesn't have quite the cultural zeitgeist with the US. But these were very popular, many of them, in Italy, obviously, because they made like 100 of them or whatever.
And this is something I'm going to bring up later based on the filmography of our star of the film, Lex Barker. Like, we talk about franchise films like it's sort of a new thing in the 2000s. And in some ways it is, because you'll have like all of these spin-offs. You get the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You don't need to have every movie that's a Marvel movie have Iron Man in it. But those ideas of these kind of long-running franchises where you could have the same star appear in a dozen movies, they were deep into that. And not just in Italy, also in Germany, also in the US and other parts of the world. You know, our star, Lex Barker, got his start playing Tarzan, and played Tarzan in 5 movies. And in one of the biographies I was reading mentioned how it was only 5 Tarzan movies. Because Tarzan, we've kind of forgotten about, but was wildly popular in the US for decades.
Yeah.
And Britain.
Yeah.
US and Britain, both.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, yeah, because this is, you know, that'd be the 50s-ish, right?
Yeah.
In the 50s. Yeah. So you get people who...
And Johnny Weissmuller got his start in like the 30s, I think. So
yeah. I was just going to say, they would be remembering the Johnny Weissmuller films. They may have quite likely, because this is, again, pre-internet, quite likely also read the actual Edgar Rice Burroughs books. And if they didn't read that, they would have read like the serialized comics.
Mm-hmm. So I'm excited for this for a couple reasons. One, it's our first foreign language Robin Hood film. We've had a few that were produced in the UK. We've had some that were produced in the US. So our first kind of non-English based, or at least English language based, Robin Hood. And it's also our first that's taking Robin Hood out of his context, because we have had the Bandit of Sherwood Forest. We have had the Rogues of Sherwood Forest. We have had the Men of Sherwood Forest. Upcoming later this year, we're going to look at episodes of the television series Robin of Sherwood. But this is Robin Hood and the Pirates. We're going to get Robin Hood on a boat. We're going to get Robin Hood out of England. And I'm excited to see that, because it's good or bad, I know it will be different. I know it will at least be something I have not seen, at least in terms of the setting. Also, Robin Hood is the only character listed on the cast that is like a Robin Hood name. There's no Little John, there's no Maid Marian, there's no King Richard, there's no Prince John, there's no Sheriff of Nottingham. None of those characters am I expecting to see.
Yeah, I think the only time we've really seen anything like Robin Hood out of England in the movies that we've seen so far, he wasn't Robin Hood yet. That was the first one.
Yeah,
Douglas Fairbanks.
You're right. Yeah,
when he was in France, I think it was when he like gets captured in the tower and all that.
Yeah, yeah. Our very
first, he wasn't Robin Hood yet. He wasn't Robin Hood yet.
But yep, he wasn't Robin Hood yet. Good point. All right, so our cast and crew. Like I mentioned, the director is Giorgio Simonelli. He's got 62 films to his credit, so guy was churning some things out. At least 8 of those that I could find were with these two comedians, Franco Franchi and Chico Ingracia, who played characters named Chico and Franco in these different movies that all seem to be comedy, like historical comedy films, like these two characters who are in General Custer's army, these two characters who are in the French Revolution, these two characters who are hanging out with geisha in medieval Japan, these two characters who are tangling with Al Capone. So this weird historical comedy duo that worked with this director for a whole bunch of movies.
Hmm.
Our writers were Eduardo Anton, Leo Bamba, and Marcello Ciorcorellini. Like I said, it stars Lex Barker, and I'm going to get back to him in a moment, because reading about our star of this film was a journey for me, and I want to share this journey with you. So also in this film is Jocelyn Lane, who's going to play a character named Karen Blaine. Some interesting background on Jocelyn Lane. She was a model, an actress. She started using her career with the stage name Jackie Lane. But there was another actress in Britain at the time also using Jackie Lane. Rick, you at least will be familiar with the other Jackie Lane's most famous character. Does the name Dodo Chaplet mean anything to you?
Oh, I've heard of that. Why is it pinging my brain?
Dorothy Dodo Chaplet.
I'm thinking, Doctor Who at all?
Yeah, she was a doctor.
Oh my gosh. And oh, she is. Kid. No, you're right. Oh my God, very early.
Yeah, man, with Hartnell. Yeah.
Wait a minute. Wow. Okay.
But that is that is not the actress
other
in this
Jackie
movie.
Lane.
Yes. That is the Jackie Lane that the actress in this movie kept getting confused for.
All right. You got her in your head. You imagine her? She's not in this.
Yeah. No. No Doctor Who connected. So Jocelyn Lane moved to the US, started working in Hollywood, started using her actual name instead of her stage name. She starred in a bunch of B movies. She was opposite Elvis Presley in the movie Tickle Me. She had a bunch of television appearances, including Man from U.N.C.L.E. She ended up retiring from acting in the 1970s, so while she was still pretty young, married Spanish royalty.
Oh, nice gig if you can get it.
Yeah.
Yeah. And she also became a little bit of a pop culture icon in the late 60s and through the 70s, specifically because of the poster for a trashy motorcycle film called Hell's Bells. And like, go ahead and look up the poster for this movie. It's this kind of ground level shot of her in the foreground wearing a leather mini skirt with her head turned back over her shoulder, having this very little bit defiant look. But it was such an iconic image that...
Oh, that's a great image.
Yeah, people really knew it at the time. Like,
what year was that? 1969? That'd be a bit risque for 69.
Yeah. And
skirt, an upskirt shot on a miniskirt that short? And leather?
Yeah.
Who needs the moon lane?
Somebody was scheming.
You've got Hell's Bells.
Yeah. I would actually be shocked, Theo, if our father would not recognize that image instantly.
I can believe it. It a motorcycle movie? Yeah.
Yeah. kind of countercultural motorcycle movie from the late 60s, early 70s.
Oh,
he's
yeah.
Damn, 100%.
I'm almost shocked that there's not a poster for this at your parents' house. Almost.
A little bit.
Yeah.
There's a little Papke family background for the listeners there. That information came from H. David Schleicher's biography on IMDb. Let's see. We also have Rosanna Rory playing Lisbeth Brooks in the film. Rosanna Rory was a high-profile model starting at the age of 17 in Italy, you know, on covers of magazines, moved to Hollywood, moved in like the right circles, definitely knew people, was kind of getting those auditions, getting the shots, but never really had a big break in Hollywood. A little bit more success in Italy.
One of those working actors where they never get that big break, but do.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. Like, we talk about B movies a lot and, you know, times when an actor goes overseas and everything, but a lot of times that's just what they have to do to kind of continue their career. Hollywood has always been fickle and very, what's the word I want? Exploitative. Well, and that's the thing is Hollywood has a royalty and they don't like to talk and they deny it.
Yeah, right? They want to pretend it's a meritocracy.
They want to pretend it's a meritocracy, but and this is not to denigrate any of the actors who are children of other actors. I don't want to be that way, but they get opportunities because of who their parentage is. And sometimes it works out and you get, you know, somebody who gets a breakout because, you know, and they genuinely have you
oh,
know,
yeah. No, there's some very talented actors. You know, I think like we were talking earlier before we started recording about how you're playing a game based on Lower Decks, a role-playing game, which stars Randy Quaid.
Jack Quaid.
Jack Quaid.
Jack Quaid, who's Dennis Quaid's kid.
Yeah, the son of Dennis Quaid and Meg Ryan.
Yep. Now, he's a good actor. I don't want to denigrate Jack Quaid. If you listen to this podcast, I love you, man. And Lower Decks is funny as the crossover episode with Stranger Worlds is seriously the best Star Trek episode I've ever seen in my life.
Exactly. But Hollywood, you know, connections there, but still very talented.
Mm-hmm. But it ends up, you can end up with very talented people who end up not getting a break when maybe if they'd been somebody's kid, they would have. And I don't, again, I'm not denigrating anybody's success and everything, but it is one of those things of like, you know, you will see a lot of working actors who can be very good, strong character actors, you know, and everything, but never get that big break, you know, because they either don't fit a model, don't fit a particular stereotype or model or mental picture and everything, you know, but a lot of times they'll have fan bases. And you know, there's ones I think of quite often, you know, Richard Schiavelli, tremendously productive character actor. And of course the amazing Jeffrey Combs, who has just a huge fan base, but never got an A-list starring role and everything. Even though he's been on Star Trek more than anybody.
Rosanna Rory has more of that starlet who never made it quality. However, the next actor I was going to highlight, Mario Scaccia, is exactly the sort of actor you were just talking about. He's playing a character called Jonathan Brooks in this film, and he has acting credits that go from 1952 to 2008.
Jeez, oh, Pete.
Wow.
Yeah, so
yeah, those, that like, is just a solid working actor. Yeah. Solid working actor. And you'll see a lot of those. And it's Vincent Schiavelli, not Richard Schiavelli. I misspoke earlier. But yeah, no, it's... Yeah, and I happen to love that, love character actors. You know, those actors who bring a lot to a scene, but aren't necessarily the big lead of a movie or a TV show. I love seeing that kind of actor, and I always wish them all the success in the world.
Yeah, another one of those types of actors is in this movie, Walter Barnes, who plays a character called Guercio. And Walter Barnes, again, load of credits for decades, lots of Westerns. Probably the most high-profile role for him was this Sheriff Sam Shaw in High Plains Drifter with Clint Eastwood. But numerous sheriff characters, numerous outlaw characters, lots of Westerns. Again, tons and tons of credits. Walter Barnes is going to be one of those very distinctive kind of character actors to look for in this film. Let's see. Other actors who had relatively high billing in the film include Edith Peters, Giulio Donini, Renato Chianotti, Mario Pesanti, Marco Tulli, Gino Bazzanca, and Renato Maddalena. All right, our star though, Lex Barker. You guys ready?
All right, tell us about Tarzan.
I embraced.
Okay, yeah. So born in the year 1919 in Rye, New York, the direct descendant of Roger Williams, who was the founder of Rhode Island, also had the Governor General of Barbados as a direct ancestor in there as well. His father was a wealthy stockbroker, so huge mansion, all kinds of privilege, and 6'4", athletic, known for his good looks. So this is a guy who has basically every advantage imaginable. Goes to Princeton, but then drops out to pursue his dream as an actor and gets disowned by his family for it.
Wow.
Moves to Hollywood, is having trouble making a break because he's not a known face. As we were just discussing, you know, he's even though he has all this privilege, he's not Hollywood royalty. He's coming from outside Hollywood, and he's too handsome, too tall to like get bit roles, to be one of those working character actors, but he hasn't broken in as a leading man. Then Hitler invades Poland. And even before Pearl Harbor, and he has gotten a contract with, I think, 20th Century Fox at this point, but is only getting very occasional small parts, having a hard time making it as an actor, but enlists in the army even before the U.S. Enters the war, rises to the rank of major, gets wounded in action. In what I read was both in his leg and head, supposedly. Oh, wow. So ends up at after the war, back in Hollywood, apparently recovered from his injuries, thankfully, good for him. And then does get his big break in 1949, cast as Tarzan in the movie Tarzan's Magic Mountain. So we've got this guy from Privilege who left that privilege to become a war hero, has finally gotten his big break after the war. He does four more Tarzan films, and then a bunch of other action films as well, mostly Westerns. Then goes on to kind of leave the US and mostly work in foreign markets. He makes over 50 films in foreign markets that include Brazil, Germany, Spain, Yugoslavia, Italy, Lebanon, France. He speaks English, French, Spanish, Italian, and German. He becomes especially popular in Germany, where he makes 13 movies that are all based on the works of a popular author, Carl May, including seven films that are all Westerns, playing a character called Old Shatterhand. This is another one of those examples of these kind of franchise films that were existing
Holy
in Germany
cow.
At that time. Wow. He wins Germany's Bambi Award for Best Foreign Actor in 1966. So at this point, I'm like, yeah, okay. I am excited to see this guy as our Robin Hood.
I gotta admit, I'm hyped.
Yeah.
But there's more.
Uh-oh.
So,
why you gotta do that to me?
I'm going to read a list of names for you. At least one of these I expect you to recognize. Constanza Thurlow, Arlene Dahl, Lana Turner, Irene Labhart, and Carmen Cervera.
Lana Turner, I know.
Yeah, Lana Turner, big name actress. Most of the rest of those, also actresses. You know what else they all had in common?
I'm going to guess ex-wives.
Yes.
Oh, man.
So he was married five times.
I'm not going to judge somebody for
no,
you know, yeah.
Mm-mm. No, no. As a
serial monogamist myself,
I'm somebody who has gotten divorced. Not, you know, myself. Yeah. There's nothing wrong with having a marriage not work out. Nothing wrong with getting divorced. However, Lana Turner in that list, very famous. Her daughter, from an earlier marriage, before she was married to Lex Barker, Cheryl Crane, wrote a tell-all book when she was an adult, so many years later. And this was after Lex Barker had passed, so he was not able to respond to any of the claims that Cheryl made. But according to Cheryl, Lana had to kick Lex out of their house at one point at gunpoint because...
Oh.
Of the extreme level of tension and fear that she experienced. And according to Cheryl, while she was in her early teens, she was molested repeatedly by Lex Barker.
Oh, dear.
Oh.
Yeah. Oh, dear. Barker passed away just after having turned 54, died of a heart attack on the streets of New York. While he was on his way to visit his girlfriend, who was another actress, and also over 30 years younger than him.
Oh.
So, my rising excitement for this guy as our Robin Hood started to nosedive a little bit. You know,
yeah.
These are accusations. They're not founded, but really... There's no reason kind of not to believe Cheryl Crane about these sort of things. There's no real benefit to her for lying about them. And even though he was never charged with anything, it's perfectly possible that either she just didn't say anything because she was a kid, or that her mom was trying to protect her by keeping all of these things silent as well. Both of those things are entirely possible.
But and there's... You have to take this kind of stuff seriously. genuinely. Yeah. Enough women are not believed that we're not here to play judge on that.
Yeah. Sorry for bringing us down before now watching this guy as the star of our film. But I want to be upfront and honest with our audience that these are these kind of allegations that were made against this guy. While there are admirable qualities that he had, you know, being a polyglot, being a war hero, willing to follow his dreams, leaving Princeton, being disowned by his family, you know, these are some admirable things, but it doesn't mean that he was an admirable person.
If we took every single person in history who had done admirable things who turned out to be another piece of
garbage,
trash,
yeah,
we wouldn't have very many people left to who had done remarkable things to talk about. Now, that being said, that is not a forgiveness of what of anything that he may or may not have done, and not to minimize those allegations, but we have to also look at, like, you know, the person as a whole person,
and
say, yes, you did these great things, but you're also a piece of trash. But
yep, and we will have to give our thoughts about the film based purely just on the film on its own merits.
Absolutely.
All right. So what we're going to do now is we're going to take a break from recording. There will be a little musical interlude, and then we're going to come back, discuss the film, give our thoughts about the film. We will no longer be spoiler free. Answer our kind of list of questions that we have. And Rick and I will rank Lex Barker on our list of the greatest Robin Hoods of all time. Well, we may already be a little bit biased against him going in now, unfortunately, but so it
goes. I will try not to let that influence.
So we have to also count that the Robin Hood writing is from the writers. Yes, actors have a lot of input into the character, but the actor didn't write the movie or the screenplay or any of that.
And so I have seen
that disconnect.
Yeah, I have seen great actors come across like terrible actors in films because there was a bad director.
Absolutely.
Yes. And like I said, you know, we have to look at the performance. You know, there's still Kevin Spacey movies that I watch. And he is an utter piece of human garbage. And I said it.
One of the best Robin Hoods, both best like as a presentation of Robin Hood, and one of the for my money, the best Robin Hood movie stars Errol Flynn. And there is plenty of baggage that that actor has as well.
Yes. Yes. Great biography, though.
Yeah.
You're really
all right. Okay. I'm going to go ahead and pause our recording.
See you guys on the flip side.
Your heart fiddled indeed. Being a pirate is a wretched thing. Do what you want because a pirate is free. You are a pirate.
All right. So welcome back. We have now just finished watching Robin Hood and the Pirates, which had Robin Hood and had pirates.
As advertised.
Now, I was hoping that because of that title and because of the pirates, there might be a moment where they were on a ship, but that never happened.
No.
You never even see a boat.
No.
The film starts with there have been shipwrecked. I had said at the beginning that I was really looking forward to seeing something where it was Robin Hood taken out of his context, that he was away from Sherwood. Nope. Not the case.
Wait a second. You never see a forest.
He is out of his
context.
They often stand in front of some woods.
There's a
woods. There's air quotes around those woods.
Yeah. Yeah. But it is very specifically Sherwood. Because he's the son of the Lord of Sherwood, and he has just returned and is fighting the usurper who killed his father and took the title of Lord of Sherwood. And it's treated like it's its own country.
They very specifically call it the county and sometimes earldom of Sherwood.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which are two different things.
Yeah.
Earldom and county.
Yeah.
Okay. So we had the expectation of being away from Sherwood, and it wasn't a Sherwood that we might really recognize, but it was still called Sherwood. It was a Robin Hood Comes Home. This time, instead of having his merry men in the forest, he's got a group of pirates that live on the coastline.
Yep.
Exclusively on the coastline.
So, yeah. Okay, one of the things that I'm going to go ahead and get out right away is how weirdly similar it was to the Kevin Costner Prince of Thieves movie.
I could see that.
Because both of them have Robin returning to England, returning home after being in the Crusades. So that is the situation in both of these films. And then finding out that his father has been killed by the villain, in this case, Lord Brooks, who is the usurper who has become Lord of Sherwood. And Sherwood, for the listeners, do not picture a forest. Picture a castle on a cliffside.
Kind of arid looking, rocky.
Yeah, very Mediterranean coasts. And then at one point, they're having a fight, and the villain says, "Take a close look at this sword. This was your father's sword that I killed him with." You know,
yeah.
Which is very much mirrors a scene that Alan Rickman will say 33 years later.
Yeah.
Also, villain is trying to marry the love interest to cement his political desires, which is also right out of the Prince of Thieves film. And the staff fight that he has with one eye at the beginning of the movie, it's the staff fight. They're in the water at the ocean, like on the beach.
Instead of over water, a creek.
And then after which Robin gets to become the leader of the band. Again, really similar to the fight between Robin Hood and the Little John from Prince of Thieves. So yeah. Like,
Prince of Thieves is a remake of this movie, confirmed.
Yes. Yep. You heard it here first. All of their ideas from this movie.
Shot for shot remake.
Shot remake.
I wrote down here that they were trying, I think, to have a little bit of a Little John dynamic.
Oh, yeah.
One, 100%.
Yeah, One Eye is very much a Little John type figure.
Yeah. And my main on this, you know, the how did it fare expectations is Robin Hood was generic protagonist guy.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. Just, very much.
It was not getting Robin Hood vibes off of him for the most part.
He was not bad as generic protagonist guy, but that's what he was. We didn't have Maid Marian, but we had the character of Karen Blaine, who was Maid Marian in everything but name.
Yeah.
And she was, I don't know, about as good as you might expect for such a role.
There was no chemistry.
None. There was even a part that was kind of creepy, and I even put it down as funny banter, but not really banter, but just I think the translation made it sound funnier than it really was. But at one point he's like points out a necklace that she's wearing, and he says, "You still wear this? I gave it to you when you were a child.
Yeah.
You gave it to me when I was a child, remember?"
Bizarre. There was a lot of bizarre, weird, slight editing glitches like that. But we also don't know how old he was.
Yeah,
But you'd think if they had both been the same age, he would have said, "When we were children,"
right?
Yeah. It was a weird moment and very poorly edited. I did like her introduction as a character. The Lord Brooks is about to execute somebody for having fought back basically when some guards had roughed him up, and she's trying to buy his freedom. She's like taking off her jewelry and being like, "Here, you can't hang this innocent man. He deserves to go free. What'll it take? Let me buy his freedom." So she had a good introduction. She was kind of established as a kind of charitable and likable person. But then it just kind of became, "Oh, I need Robin to rescue me. Oh, I hope Robin doesn't come rescue me because it's a trap for him. oh, I don't want to marry Lord Brooks, you know, like.
There was a little bit later on, because there was a point in the stables where she's received Brooks's marriage, quote unquote, proposal. And, you know, there's a whole thing of like, you know, I don't want to marry him. That guy. Pardon my French. Forget that guy, you know, and everything. And that was actually like, that was an okay little scene. And again, you could tell they were trying to establish the character. It's just, it's a limited time movie. But I feel like they did more to try to establish her as a character than Robin.
And there is a lot of, we need to establish Robin as like the strong heroic guy. Like when he rescues her from the castle at one point, they go out through the secret passage and they need to go down these cliffs. And he's carrying her down these cliffs. So it's very dangerous. And there's no particular reason why she couldn't walk herself. But it's like, we have to so much establish that Robin Hood's the strong guy, this He-Man, this hero, that he has to carry her. But it really undercuts her own agency and ability.
Yeah. I will say that you could see both in the costuming and in characterization, the influence of Flynn.
Oh, yes. Very, very much.
But the problem that you ended up with is like, they kept trying to have him say snarky things, but he just ends up monologuing.
And they definitely were trying to channel Errol Flynn as much as possible from his costume, from the moment he's battling the villain and says, "Pick up your sword," which is a line in the Errol Flynn Robin Hood. Although it's delivered with so much more panache, you know, "Your sword, Gisborne," in the Errol Flynn. And also in that scene, they were also trying to evoke the 38 film, because they kept trying to do the showing the sword fighting by having the shadows on the wall, which was one of those Michael Curtiz, you know, specialties, and something they did magnificently in that film in 38. Here they did not do it as well, but they were so much trying to pull from that. There was clearly an inspiration for them.
Like I wrote down, why are they showing us the pirates eating instead of the sword fight?
I love that. I thought that was hilarious.
Yeah, that was, I love that.
It was funny, but like, it was weird.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was, it was One Eye and Hook. They're just hanging out while Brooks and Robin are fighting.
They have a little comedy bit with One Eye putting a candle on the Hook's hook to keep him from getting the food, but then he can't eat the food, so he's having to feed it to him. And
yeah.
Well, and it's, you know, it's weird because Hook has another hand, but it's his left hand.
Yeah.
And you don't pick up food with your left hand in the Mediterranean.
Yeah.
Because that's the hand you use for other purposes.
Yeah.
And it's considered unclean in a lot of Mediterranean cultures.
Interesting.
Yep. Nope, that's true.
Huh. It's why you never...
He was like, I can't... I've got this candle on my hook, and I can't pick up this food with my left hand. So when I had to feed it to him.
Yep. They also got a few tender moments, Hook and One Eye.
Yeah, like they after their escape.
It was cute. I was... Oh, sorry, you were saying, Theo?
Yeah, it was after the escape. Robin and... I almost called her Marion, Karen... are having a cute little makeout session, and Hook just starts gently caressing One Eye's hair with his hook, and then starts leaning in for a little kiss.
One Eye seems into it for a moment too. I was getting shades of "Our Flag Means Death" there.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Little bit. We're joking, but I'm not kidding. That vibe was there.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, it very much was.
Yeah.
Yeah. So we kind of covered our Robin Hood here. Very generic. We covered our stand-in for Marion, because she really is just a stand-in for Marion. We have Lord Brooks as our stand-in for Prince John / Sheriff of Nottingham. He's kind of fulfilling sort of both of those roles at the same time. I thought he was perfectly serviceable as a villain. You know, if he had had a little mustache, he would have twirled it every now and then, because he was just very villainous.
I got a little bit of enjoyment whenever he popped up, because he's such a delightfully messed up little guy.
Yeah.
Like, he would always be like, "Ooh, I enjoy them when they suffer." But like not he didn't have quite as much gravitas as some characters from like the Errol Flynn, but he was trying to go for it, and I still smiled at how delightfully sinister he was.
Yeah, and I like that even though he was clearly this like middle-aged guy and didn't look all athletic, could still basically hold his own in a sword fight, not with as much jumping up onto the table as Robin Hood, but still climbing up onto it at least.
That is one thing I will say, at least at the start of the movie, not so much later on in the movie, Lex Barker did have a good amount of physicality. Mm-hmm. Like, he felt some energy there. Nothing like Fairbanks. I mean,
no.
Fairbanks, friggin' crazy.
He's a dynamo.
But you could feel it. And I will say that like I had high hopes because the first fight in this movie is actually quite good. And not to jump ahead too much, but my best example of swashbuckling is actually from that fight.
Yeah, we'll get to that when we get to the swashbuckling section. One other point I wanted to bring up in terms of our villains, because we had a few villains. He was definitely the primary villain, but then we also had his daughter, and we had Goliath, the jester, the hunchback jester. And he was a little harder to figure out what was going on with him, but I kind of liked the dynamic with the daughter, Lisbeth, and the father, because while they were these villains and they were the nobles, they had also usurped the position from being of a lower class. Lord Brooks had been the steward of Robin's father before murdering him and somehow totally getting away with it and getting a new lord.
It's how executive power works.
But that backstory, especially, it came out mostly with the daughter, with Lisbeth, that it mattered to her, that she had kind of grown up, not exactly poor, but not wealthy, not high status, and like it was important to her that she cling to that now that she had it, and important that they like try to find a good marriage match for her, and important that, you know, she had this jealousy of the Karen Blaine character because she had, their roles had sort of become reversed. Karen had been the wealthier one when she was younger and had been friends with Lord of Sherwood, you know, Robin and his father and all that. So I thought that was at least an interesting dynamic. It wasn't explored very thoroughly, but at least it was something. And as much as she was conniving, she did have some sort of genuine affection for Robin.
Oh, yes.
Well, and it was weird. Her motivations were kind of a little all over the place.
Yeah, like I said.
Like, I got her jealousy of Karen, which culminated in a girl fight in a mud pit.
Yeah, we had mud wrestling in this movie.
Yep. In full medieval gowns, without any sort of crazy ripping or anything, which I, you know, at least appreciated that.
They got down and dirty.
They didn't go pure sex.
Yeah, I mean, the movie was reasonably misogynistic and casually racist, but...
Yes, well, like, the pirates had all of these women there for reasons are not stated.
Who were, like, calypso belly dancers, and one woman was Asian and wearing an Asian-style dress and just kind of this generic exotification of the women. They get called Saracens at one point, which was very weird.
Yeah, I didn't even notice the Asian character until almost the end of the movie. I was like, what? She wearing a Vietnamese dress you probably wouldn't see centuries later.
Yeah, casually racist and casually anachronistic.
Yeah. And Lisbeth, she obviously has a thing for Robin to the point that she throws herself in front of him to take an arrow to the belly. But And you could tell that the actress was definitely trying, like to characterize this woman and everything.
Yeah. Rosanna Roy was that actress.
I enjoyed her performance. I did. Mm-hmm.
I mean, I have to say, Robin Hood was very generic feeling, but I didn't dislike any of the performances. Walter Barnes as One Eye was perhaps the most fun.
Yeah, bombastic. Very, he was enjoyable.
He was the pirate, and he was living up to that. Aha, ha, ha, ha.
Yeah.
That was half of his dialogue.
Like, beyond expectation, he was going leaning hard into that.
I loved how much he kept bringing in like the pirate terms. They're like going to ride off in a cart, and he's like, anchors away. They're fighting on the castle ramparts.
Throw him overboard.
Like, yeah, throw him overboard.
If I only had my ship under me.
All hands on deck.
Hunting down that one guard which had a big feathery helmet and going, ah, hello, there's my bird of paradise. I'll get your feathers.
Yeah. And then we don't get to see him actually kill the guy. He just suddenly has his helmet.
Yeah.
Yeah. But three times in the movie, it's this running gag that there's this captain of the guards with this big, like, ostrich plume feathers on his helmet. And One Eye's like, ah, I'm going to get those feathers.
Yeah.
And keeps calling the captain of the guard his bird of paradise. It's
right. By the way, the Brooks's guards in this movie are amazingly incompetent. They are beyond the level that you expect in a Robin Hood movie of the soldiers to be incompetent. They are heads and shoulders below that cost.
They're full on stormtrooper incompetent, I'd say.
The soldiers and men in tights were more competent.
They have a convoy of weapons, and they get ambushed, and they don't grab any of them. None.
So
the pirates are attacking the convoy, and they're just standing there looking at the creek that they're at, just like, huh? And then they get pushed in. It's just like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Theo just mentioned Men in Tights, and we had commented on how Lex Barker and with the costuming and everything, they were trying to channel Errol Flynn, but his costume throughout the entire film, he only has one costume, is almost identical to what Cary Elwes wears in Men in Tights. And like that is our opening shot of the movie too, is him shipwrecked on the beach with this slow pan up his legs covered in those green tights.
Yep, just first shot, green tights.
Yep.
Yeah.
And green tights, and then the brown jerkin. But that is the costume that you should imagine in your mind, listeners, is Cary Elwes. So just imagine somebody less charming and affable and funny as Cary Elwes, but, I don't know, slightly taller and more buff. And that is the Robin Hood in this movie.
Well, and let me just say that overall, Lex Barker was not unenjoyable. Like, he was not bad, like some of the Robins or Sons of Robins that we've seen.
Yeah, Sons of Robins. Because we'll get to our ranking with him and how he sits.
Yeah. But I will say that he was not unenjoyable to watch. Mostly kind of what throws it off is he had more chemistry with One Eye than he did with Kara.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, yes.
Definitely.
His royal man's man.
Yeah. And I felt like the actress was trying.
Oh, sure.
Just wasn't there. And he was kind of eh.
And that was Jocelyn Lane, who was playing that character at that time, going by Jackie Lane. Next on our list, Feat of Archery. And for over an hour into this film, I was worried there wasn't going to be any archery.
An hour and 5 minutes.
Yep.
Until Robin Hood gets a bow.
I clocked
there
that.
There is one piece of archery that he supposedly does at the very start of the movie. Don't see him with a bow. We just see an arrow go through and slice a rope on a gibbet.
I thought it was a dagger. It looked like a dagger.
Was it a dagger? Okay, I guess that must have been a dagger. But yeah, no, like there's no archery, and then none of it's impressive.
Yeah, the first archery that we see is some guards shooting a guard that he is holding in front of him. The guard's even like, no, don't shoot. And the other guards just straight up shoot him and kill their buddy anyway. Speaking of these incredibly incompetent guards, I guess they're better than stormtroopers because they were able to hit something.
But that's true.
But then he grabs a bow and shoots the hangman that's about to kill Karen and says, "No place for a hangman in my county." And he's, you know, he's doing it from up on the battlements. It's a reasonably far shot. It's not like a awesome trick shot, but I'll give that points for a decent shot. So that was my pick as best feat of archery. I think it counts.
Yeah, I had written down that the early scene where shooting that rope, because I thought he had inexplicably managed to shoot an arrow with no bow and no arrows.
I'll go back and look, because you do see something flying through the shot. But I'm pretty sure it was a dagger, and we had seen him with a dagger in his...
That would make more sense.
I believe you that it's a dagger. Honestly, yeah. I'm not, like, the thing about it is I think I assumed it was an arrow because it's Robin Hood.
Right, and this is a thing flies through the air and hits, you know, the rope of a noose.
If this had been a better movie, you would have seen that, if it had been a dagger, you would have seen it go thwong into the wood, you know.
You would have seen him throw
it. This is a low-budget Italian. Yeah. I literally have written in my notes, because I was waiting for it, was, does Robin Hood actually hold a bow at any point in this whole movie?
Yeah, but he does, eventually.
He does, eventually. And then I have, not until an hour and 5 minutes in.
Yeah. All right. Not much else to mention there. But the movie does okay for swashbuckling. There's a lot of swashbuckling in the film.
Yes.
So that's our next question, is what is the best feat of swashbuckling, or best swashbuckling moment?
For me, diving into the ocean at the start. Like the whole little sword fight, and then he goes over the cliff. I felt that. And I have, as a backup, I did kind of like when he got up on the gibbet and like grabbed the little rope.
Mm-hmm. I'd almost consider that the same part, because that was the same escape. He jumps up on that, swings around, and then he climbs up to the ramparts, fights, and jumps off into the sea.
Yeah.
Overall, the movie didn't have amazing choreography and stunts, but it had decent stuff. You know, you had people jumping out from trees onto people on horseback. I mean, it was kind of ridiculous. They were very low hanging trees, and the idea that the people on horseback couldn't see them was very weird and nonsense. But you had those feats. You had a lot of sword fighting, you know, multiple scenes throughout. Much better sword fighting than we have seen in several other films. So again, not amazing sword fighting, but a lot better than some of the other things we've seen. You know, pretty passable. And like I said earlier, when he's fighting the villain in his feast hall, he's jumping up on the table. It's not a bad scene. It's pretty swashbuckly. But my pick too is also the one right at the beginning, where he's fighting off several guards, jumps onto the gallows stand, swings on the noose rope that he had cut earlier, then makes his way up to the battlements and dives into the ocean. That whole sequence. And I did especially like the swinging on the rope of the gallows part. So I think we're all agreed that that's the best, most swashbuckly moment in a movie that at least was pretty action-y.
Yeah. As a runner-up, I wrote at one point one eye when they're in the castle as part of some their escape. Robin, Karen, and Hook go through the escape doorway, and he stays back to hold off some guards, grabs a halberd, jumps on the table, going, "Ah, ha, 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 ah."
Yeah. That was pretty good.
Fending them off effectively and taunting his bird of paradise.
Yeah. the first of the three times. So our next category is wittiest bit of banter. And again, we actually did get multiple choices. It's not like an amazingly written film. It's not a hysterical film. But I got a few genuine laughs throughout the movie. And there were a number of good lines. I think there are some solid contenders for wittiest banter here.
I agree. Oh, some of my laughs were from the weird editing and mistranslations.
Yeah. All right, Theo, do you have a pick for wittiest bit of banter?
Yeah, I've got one. It was pretty early on. The peasant who's about to be hung, he fought back because he couldn't pay his taxes, and so Brooks says to him, "Okay, I promise you from now on you will have no taxes. Hang him at once."
Yeah.
Yeah.
That was perfect.
Yeah, and there was a bit of variety. There wasn't just like a, oh, only one person gets all the good lines. I mean, I don't know that any of the lines I wrote down were anything Robin Hood said. He was not the one where we were getting our witty banter.
One, I had some good lines, but actually I really liked, there was one from, that was later on in the movie, where Hook has a guard, and he's like, do you like the way I use my crochet hook? And then proceeds to, like, you know, jab the guy in the neck.
Yeah, calling his hook hand his crochet hook was pretty good.
Yeah, I liked that one. That one was good. And I also liked when you know, the fight is wrapping up, and he's like, it's all over but the shouting. I liked that one.
Yeah, that was pretty good. I liked it when Sweet Pea said, I take back the dirty, but you're still dogs.
Yeah. Oh, that was a good one. Yeah, that was a good one.
I also liked early in the movie after Robin had defeated One Eye in their one-on-one combat, and they all had agreed that he was then going to be their leader. And, you know, Robin's like, you're with me, right? And he's like, and One Eye's response is, I can't resist you when you use such charming persuasion.
I'm telling you, One Eye
had
some tension with some people in that movie.
And then I think what might have been my favorite line, a little misogynistic in terms of the context of the film, was when Robin has rescued Karen and he comes to the pirates' camp, and one of them says, I see you've been poaching from his lord's private reserve.
Oh, yeah. It's a good line. That's a little...
Wow.
Yeah. But then also, just they weren't witty exactly, but I did get a kick out of all of One Eye's comments about, you know, hoist the anchor, all hands on deck.
I have one more. It harkens back to one of the other films, which did a little better. I forget the exact lines, but it was Brooks is taunting Karen, trying to be like, hey, you should marry me. And then they change the topic to Robin Hood. And I promise you that before long, he will be enjoying my hospitality. And as he's saying this, he's reaching out behind him to have someone fill his goblet with wine. And the hand that pours it says, thanks for the invitation, Brooks. And it's Robin filling his wine.
Yeah,
that was probably Robin's wittiest line in the whole movie.
It was a good moment. I like that one. That was probably one of my favorite Robin Hood moments there.
And a very Errol Flynn moment. Very Errol Flynn. Like, this is the thing. I will say, like, Brooks, not Claude Rains, but trying to be charming like that.
Yes, that was Mario Scaccia. Yeah. Is that actor. Yeah.
And I will say, closer to pulling it off than other attempts I have seen.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. I would agree with that.
Yeah.
So next category is your choice for the merriest man. This is the character from the film who, other than Robin, who you would pick to be a member of your outlaw band were you to be forming one.
I have a pick.
All right. Theo, do you have one?
I do think I ultimately have a pick. Yeah.
I feel like there are two standouts, two really good choices.
I'm curious to see how we fall.
So, Rick, what's yours?
I was a bit torn. It almost went to One Eye by default just because he had so much screen time. But I'm going to pick Sweet Pea. She holds One Eye to task. She's cooking for everybody at the beginning. Again, a little bit of misogyny there, but... But she's also, at the end, she's the first of the pirates to go and get into the group and start rallying people to rise up against Brooks. So she is my pick for Merriest Man. On the context of who I would most want as a member of my outlaw gang.
That was my pick, too. Yeah, I was sitting there, like, I kind of had an inkling, like, oh, she seems like she could be it more interesting. She could be my pick. But we're not getting much of her through most of the movie until, yeah, kind of the end where she, yeah, takes One Eye to task, as Rick said, and leads the charge of the pirates, basically.
Yeah, well, so she doesn't lead the pirates. She does something more impressive at the end.
Oh,
so
that's right.
I similarly, I put her down early in the movie. as she was likely my choice. She was fun. She was not taking any guff. She also could clearly cook, but also seemed very friendly, seemed kind, mm-hmm. like had a good rapport with Robin. But then she was not in the movie for the longest time. And my focus very much shifted to One Eye. And I was like, okay, well, it'll probably be him. He is really fun. That whole Bird of Paradise bit was just so, so great. And he was like genuinely like there helping Robin. He was felt like a very solid pick. But then at the end, like you said, she's the one that takes the pirates for task when they're going to abandon Robin. They're like, we're kind of given up. We've sort of lost. She takes them to task, goes off with just the other women and rallies the townsfolk. And yep. like they're about to hang Robin, and she comes bursting in like, are we going to put up with this? Come on. And just leads a revolt. Just basically through force of personality.
And keep in mind, she has no established rapport with any of these town people. She just shows up and is just like, we're doing this.
Yeah. Are you guys going to put up with this? What are you doing? Come on. Let's go. Let's go.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it had kind of been One Eye, but then that pushed it back towards Sweet Pea. So Sweet Pea gets to be Absolutely. Our merriest man. And I think that actress is Edith Peters.
Definitely a little bit of vibes of Maude, just a little bit, but her own kind of character. And yeah, I wish she had gotten a little bit more screen time, frankly.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. At least some decent competition there. It wasn't a sure thing, but ultimate consensus. Now, our next category is how robbed were the rich? On a scale of 1 to 10, how much did Robin feel like a champion of the people? I want to do something a little different this time. I'm going to have us all just raise our fingers at the same time. All right. You ready? You got a number, Theo? Mm-hmm.
Yep.
You got your number, Rick?
Yeah.
All right. 3, 2, 1, go. Wow. That is so much disparity. Okay. So Theo is holding a goose egg. Rick is either giving a peace sign or saying he's giving him a 2. I'm giving him a 6. All right. So let's start at the bottom. Theo, 0.
So
why 0?
He was really doing all of this to put himself back into his position. He didn't seem like he was doing really any of this for the people, but for himself. Like, the people do prefer him, but there was, just because he's not a jerk who's going to tax and hang them, but there was never any time where he talked about or intended to do anything to help out the people. And, like, the most was just, oh yeah, I'll kind of pay the pirates for helping me.
Okay. Rick, why did you go with a 2?
I went with a 2 because he does in the end promise to return everything that was taken from people to them. He does also start by saving someone from an unjust hanging.
Okay,
so while I don't feel he was necessarily a huge champion of the people, he at least went through some of the motions at the beginning and the end. Like Theo, I really kind of went back and forth between like a 0 and a 1 and a 2. Like Theo said, throughout most of the movie, he's not doing any of this except, you know, to reinforce the feudal system, right. But with him in charge. He's not particularly past some words at the beginning and the end. He's not particularly outraged by Brooks's treatment of the populace. He mm-hmm. doesn't feel any particular compassion or empathy for them. They're just background dressing. They're there to serve whoever is sitting in the chair, and he wants to sit in that chair. Not out of greed, but out of entitlement.
I think that is some good points. And I, to the point that I could be willing to reassess my points there. For most of the film, I was definitely hovering around the 2-3 range for the exact same reason. Willing to give him sort of the benefit of the doubt in that he was actively working against an oppressive, tyrannical figure. And he could have left. He could have left at any time. He was basically at his own liberty throughout the film. I'm not sure where he would have gone. But he didn't necessarily have to stay. He chose to stay. Like, yes, he was trying to get himself back into his position of power. But like you said, there's at least some of those motions. He does rescue that guy at the beginning. And he's fighting and putting his life on the line to create a situation that will be better for people. As you say, yeah, puts himself in charge. So it is also not purely altruistic. But what did elevate it for me at the end and pushed it at least up towards the 5 range, at least in that Midland area, was that line at the end where he's already won. He doesn't need to do anything. He never promised anybody that he was going to give them something. But he does. He's already won. And he says, hey, I know this guy has been a tyrant. I know he's unjustly taxed you and he's repossessed your homes and taken things from you. I'm going to give it all back. And that was enough to push it up in terms of that scale of, like, you know, champion of the people. Oh, he's going to return the things that were taken. It's not just that he's kicked the bad person out of power, but that he will actively, at least in theory, it's what he says, that he will make restitution to them. That pushed it up in my estimation.
That's a very good point. I'll reevaluate my score and bump him up to a 4 or 5.
I had forgotten
that, because that is some very good will and good point with he didn't promise them and did just do this. He didn't have to. He didn't promise it. And so
I'm sticking with my 2.
Yeah, I mean, so we're averaging in that, like, still the lower half of the spectrum. I think that's reasonable. I think him coming in somewhere, the aggregate that to around a 4, I think that ends up being pretty fair for him.
Yeah, I would have liked to seen just a little bit more, right? Like, even a little bit of lip service. Even just, like, he never really interacts with any of the peasantry.
No.
At all.
He interacts with the villains, Karen, and the pirates.
Yep, and that's it. And
he does. And
that's why it's a 2.
He does make the pirates promise to stop being pirates at the end.
He does make the pirates stop to be promised, but he's going to use money from the treasury to give them a new ship. Not clear whether that's, you know, taxation money or inheritance money or what the difference of that is.
Presumably inheritance, because he did promise he was going to give everything back to everybody else.
Yes. Well, but I think it was everything that was unjustly taken, probably not their actual quote-unquote legitimate taxes, which at this point are borderline theft. I have opinions about the feudal system.
you don't think we should go back to that, do you?
Oh, hell no.
Okay, I say that, and I'm now living in a country where I've got a king.
Yeah, you do have a king, at least for the minute. Let's not get into my opinions of the current British royal family and their role in the British government, or
lack thereof. Yeah. Okay. So, are there any other low points? I think we've hit a lot of them. A bit of weird editing, certainly. The dialogue, which had some fun, clever moments, was otherwise not very memorable. The plot was kind of basic. So there wasn't really an exciting story to follow. It was pretty easy to kind of check out.
Basic, yet also kind of convoluted in a weird way. Character motivations are there, but, like, some of the character motivations, like I said, never really picked up on what Lisbeth's real character motivations were at any time. They seemed to shift around. Yeah, the writing needed help. The editing needed a lot of help. The soundtrack did not fade between places. It just suddenly switched music with no ligature. You also had things like I have here when Brooks is riding through the quote-unquote forest, and suddenly it's like, oh no, a thin net, my one weakness.
Yeah, like why did that stop them?
Like you have swords.
A net hanging down. No bad guys around them at this time. Just
and they're throwing nets on people, which, you know, granted is more tangling, but it's, you know. Yeah,
the super incompetency of the henchmen, where they're foiled by nets, where they can't see the men standing on the defoliated trees 6 feet in the air.
Here's quite obviously a Mediterranean tree, because it doesn't have a real trunk.
I thought at one point they were just like standing, like filming in front of like an olive orchard, because I saw like some like very small bushy trees in a rose.
I was pretty sure it was an olive orchard. They needed some trees, and that's the trees they had.
Yeah, there's that kind of whole general weirdness of, I am the Lord of Sherwood, and Sherwood isn't a forest. It's a county / earldom that exists on this coastline.
And I love that, like, at the start, they're like Robin literally says, I'm going to go into the forest. They'll never find me there. You do not see him in the forest.
Not even
an establishing shot. Nothing.
Yeah. And we didn't get any pirate ships. I'm going to count that as a low point.
Yeah.
Yes.
We did have pirates. They were pirates. They had a parrot. You know, there was one eye who had an eye patch on. Although a couple of times you like halfway through the movie, you find out that he actually can see out of both eyes.
And I think that because there is that going theory that part of the reason that pirates wear patches is to keep one eye for dark vision, which I don't know if that is, you know, nobody knows if that was really true.
I think that's been debunked.
It's probably been debunked, but I kind of like that. There was also,
there's also the hook hand.
There's also the hook hand. Fight choreography was really eh.
So the last film that we have for an entry is Wolf's Head, and the choreography is worlds above that, though.
Well, that's
when they swing their sword, they're actually like contacting the other swords.
This movie was more watchable than some of the other movies we have seen in this series. But there were some weird pacing issues. Like there's at one point the pirates are like looking up and they're like, oh, we'll never climb that. We can't climb that. We'll never make it in time. And then they unhurriedly climb up some crags.
Yeah, right? And then they just
like mosey. Or like, you know, when in the final battle, when the people like are being shot at from the top of the ramparts, they're standing in front of low walls they could be behind and just kind of looking up, and it's just like, hide, take cover.
It was a little hard to follow the action at that point.
Flipped how the, people had ended they flipped up the 180 places. Circle of action.
Yeah.
Yes.
Any other low points you want to mention there, Theo?
Yeah, we've covered most of what we've talked about. One bit with the guard ineptitude, where they've got Karen on the gallows. They're going to hang her as a trap for him, which I'll talk a little bit more later. And then so Robin pops up on his own, no backup, and Brooke says, guards, arrest him. And three guys try. There's a bunch of guards throughout, and three dudes try. He kills all three of them. They try one at a time and fail horribly, and then he just saunters past like a massive row of soldiers to talk to Brooks more directly. What are the rest doing?
Yeah. Well, they could have gotten stabbed, Theo. Gee. He just murdered three guys.
Even like throughout, there's other shots, like in big like fights when like the peasants are rising up and some other people are fighting. There's just like a row of guards with halberds at the back, just chilling while like you can see the line of other guards with swords trying to fight off.
Mm-hmm. There was also like how a lot of the peasants sort of randomly had swords all of a sudden.
Yeah.
You did see a bunch of them with like pitchforks and things. Why they had their pitchforks with them, that's uncertain. Always bring your pitchfork when you're coming to a hang-in, I guess.
Well, and the other thing is like some of them, let's assume they grabbed the swords off of the guards that got killed The average peasant does not know how to use a sword.
Nope.
Because of the way executive power worked back then.
Pointy end goes in the other man, Rick.
I mean, that's true. That is the instructions that are printed on the little tag on the end.
I think every
this side towards enemy.
Yes. So my overall takeaway is, if by some weird quirk of fate you are able to find a copy of this movie, you know, you could watch it. I genuinely laughed at it, and not just because of like the dubbing or because of the editing mistakes. Some of the, especially One Eye's lines, genuinely made me laugh. I thought they were funny. The action, like, again, it's not amazing, but it's not the worst. You could have a worse time watching a film. Don't expect high production values, though. Don't expect an amazing story. Is it a film that I would recommend to somebody? Not really, but doesn't mean that you couldn't enjoy it.
I wouldn't tell anybody to, oh, definitely don't watch that. Like, if it's on, go for it. If you want something to eat some popcorn and sit on a couch on a rainy day, a rainy afternoon or something, sure.
Yeah. But the one thing I did want to mention, with the realization of them just turning this into, oh, this is a pretty, like, kind of standard Robin Hood story of, oh, they, instead of the Merry Men, they're pirates, and instead of Marion, it's Karen, and instead of the sheriff, it's Brooks. There was no archery contest, because this movie doesn't have archery.
Basically, yeah.
It's not an origin movie. Yeah.
So they didn't have something to have Robin be captured, so they instead used the love interest Karen as the threat to get him into the castle. Like, all right, we're going to hang her unless Robin turns himself in. I was like, oh, that's a nice little like way to adapt their lack of an archery competition and capture Robin to keep the story going.
Mm-hmm.
But that was like the only kind of subversion of the story.
Well, yeah, and that's the kind of one of the last points I wanted to make, was how weird it was as a quote unquote Robin Hood story. Because, like I said, I was expecting a, like, let's take Robin Hood and then put him in a different context. But no, they did Robin Hood pretty similar to kind of what especially a modern movie audience would expect with Robin Hood. Return from the Crusades, he's lost his lands, he's trying to regain them, and so he forms a band of outlaws to help him in this endeavor. Again, like we discussed, not exactly because we're trying to help the oppressed, but he's trying to get his lands back. But again, that's very Kevin Costner. That's what he does. And only the band of outlaws is a group of pirates instead of outlaws living in the forest. But it still has like, oh, the love interest who's a noble lady that the bad guy's trying to marry. So it's very similar to things that happened with Maid Marian both before and after this movie. So it had all of these elements that felt very much like, oh, okay, this is a Robin Hood movie. But at the same time, it's like, oh, but it's not a Robin Hood movie because he's not in the forest. And there's One Eye instead of Little John. And there's Karen instead of Marion. It was weirdly not Robin Hood while, and, you know, almost no archery. Like, it was weirdly Robin Hood without also feeling like Robin Hood.
It lacked so many of the tropes that, like I said, if Robin Hood felt like generic protagonist guy, you could have easily just pulled off the veneer of the minor number of Robin Hood tropes that they put in, and the movie would have lost nothing.
Yeah, if his name was not Robin Hood, if the name of the place was not Sherwood, and if he wasn't wearing green tights, you know, then it would have felt more of just kind of generic-y medieval action film.
Yeah, if his name had been, you know, Giovanni de Carlo, and, you know, it would have been fine. It would have been a perfectly acceptable movie.
Yeah. You know, Giovanni.
But we wouldn't have been talking about it how many years? 74 years later?
70, 64 years later.
64 years later. Yeah. The Robin Hood branding is what made it pop up here.
This is true.
And this is where we were getting at in the intro. We were talking about how, you know, the Italians were pumping out cash grab movies. That's what this was.
Mm-hmm. Yep. But it, as a cash grab movie, it could have been worse. I could have had a worse time.
I would be curious.
I enjoyed this Fortnite of 1960.
Yeah. I would be curious because, like, so 1960, that's after the Richard Green television show.
Mm-hmm.
There's a movie coming out at that point, so there would have been just that little bit. It doesn't take much to incentivize a cash grab movie, right?
No.
Look at, I mean, Roger Corman has built his whole company around that. So yeah, all you gotta do is slap a little bit of green paint on there, and show a guy with a bow on the poster, and boom, you got a Robin Hood movie.
God, I wish they actually used some green paint and actually had like some matte paintings for forest backgrounds.
Oh, that would be way too high a budget for this. Matte painting sounds money.
All right. Well, I think we need to, at this point, discuss how generic green tight clad action man fits in our ranking of Robins.
That might be what we call it, man. Green tight. Action man.
Yeah. So there is a list that Rick and I have been maintaining for the ranking of Robins. If you go on to patreon.com/intogreenwood, as a supporter there, you get access to bonus content that includes our initial set of rankings, how we got the first six entries onto the list, a bonus episode about how Richard Green ended up on the list twice, at two such different levels. He is currently ranked in both the number 3 spot and then way back down in the number 7 spot. Rick, do you have the list pulled up?
I do.
All right. Do you want to run through quickly kind of the state of the list for us?
Right. So number 1 in an upset. At the time.
Yeah,
it's Brian Baxter.
This also has its own episode.
Yes, from Disney's animated Robin Hood, which we both agreed he just felt the most Robin Hood of Robin Hoods, like the most pure distilled Robin Hood.
Yep.
Following that is, of course, the amazing Errol Flynn, the iconic Errol Flynn, oft imitated, never duplicated. Following that is Richard Green from the Adventures of Robin Hood television series. Then Don Taylor from the Men of Sherwood Forest, who I particularly enjoyed and liked him as a working man's Robin Hood.
Yeah, dark horse candidate, that one.
Very much a dark horse, because that was a Hammer film that we went into with no expectations whatsoever and were pleasantly surprised. Then we have Richard Todd from the Story of Robin Hood, the 1952, who we both really enjoyed. That was the live-action Disney one that mm-hmm. is, you know, the non-animated Disney Robin Hood, which, again, we both enjoyed. Then Barry Ingham from a Challenge for Robin Hood, followed by Richard Green from The Sword of Sherwood Forest, in a kind of a disappointing but not terrible performance. Then in a shockingly low position is Douglas Fairbanks, who brings a lot, but overall, you know, I think it is a justified place. Then we have Daniel Warbeck from Wolf's Head, The Legend of Young Robin Hood.
David Warbeck.
David Warbeck. Thank you. I'm literally reading off the screen and read it wrong. Who is not bad. Like, I enjoyed his performance, but, you know, there were definitely some drawbacks. Then we have John Hall from Prince of Thieves, and Russell Hicks, who was really just kind of almost a walk-on of a Robin Hood.
Mm-hmm. Yep. So 11 Robins. This will be a full dozen Robins for us now with Lex Barker. And I know where I want to put him on the list.
Well, where do you want to put him on the list?
So since we have formed this list, Russell Hicks has been on the bottom. Like you said, you know, he's a little bit more than a walk-on role, but definitely a supporting cast in that film. It's The Bandit of Sherwood Forest is the movie. It's really about his son, who is terrible. And this is probably the worst film that we have watched out of all of them. But Russell Hicks is not bad at it, in it. He's playing the older Robin Hood, who kind of helps get the band back together and supports his son on his son's adventure. And we liked him pretty well. He was a good older Robin that we would not have minded to have seen more of. I'm willing to get him out of that last place, finally. He's been lingering there too long. I'm going to nominate Lex Barker for taking up the bottom spot. Maybe I am a little biased based on the comments that we made before we watched the film about Lex Barker, but trying to genuinely assess his role in this movie and how generic he was. You know, John Hall is right above Russell Hicks, and John Hall was kind of generic-y too, but he had at least a little bit more charm, a little bit more panache. You know, I didn't hate Lex Barker in this role, but he did just so much feel like this guy is buff and handsome and can string two words together. Let's slap the green tights on him.
You and I are of a similar mind. I was kind of going back and forth as to where in those bottom spots I wanted to put him. Overall, the word I have for him is inoffensive. As the character, this is not to speak to the actor person, himself. Yeah.
And allegations that may or may not be true.
And allegations that may or may not be true. But yeah, he is honestly, he's forgettable. Yeah, he's Joe outshined. Yeah, he's outshined by his sidekick.
Oh yeah.
By far. The chemistry isn't there. His delivery isn't wooden. You know, he's obviously is trying to emote, but it just falls. It doesn't feel off. It just feels like nothing. And he's utterly kind of forgettable. I support him being put in that number 12 spot because I don't feel, he didn't feel very Robin Hood-y for the most part overall, whether even in characterization. Like I said, he doesn't interact with any of the peasantry, so we don't get really a sense of like he genuinely cares about the plight of the people. You know, there's very none of the standard merry men or characters to interact with, so we don't get really a lot of that. He doesn't pick up a bow for the first hour plus of the movie, so we don't get that. And while he does try to channel a little bit of Errol Flynn for some of the witty banter, he's not the wittiest banter character in the movie.
Yeah, he does get some points for like saving that guy right off the bat, being daring, jumping from the ramparts, you know, breaking into the castle multiple times. So he gets some of the swashbuckling points, which is one of the things you do want to see a Robin do. But one of the reasons why I championed Errol Flynn when we set up the list for the top is, one, Errol Flynn is very romantic. He is a romantic leading man, and there is a, you know, he has some genuine chemistry with Olivia de Havilland. You do not have any chemistry with Jocelyn Lane. And also that champion of the people, being an inspirational figure. It was one of the other points that I felt was very important for a really good Robin Hood. And Errol Flynn had that in spades. And like we were saying, Lex Barker doesn't. Sweet Pea is the one that rallies the people, not Robin Hood.
Yeah.
Robin Hood doesn't inspire anybody to rise up. Sweet Pea.
No, and that's the thing is, like, he doesn't inspire the pirates particularly with anything but money. Yeah. Right? They don't initially help him out of any sense of personal loyalty, and they kind of don't like only barely go that way, and it's Sweet Pea who convinces them not him. He actually, like, he's like you know, they at one point in the movie decide, oh yeah, this, you know, this isn't working for us. Brooks offered us a pardon. We might even convince him to pay us to leave. So we're going to take that deal. Sorry, Robin. And he doesn't really do anything to really try and win them back at all. He just decides, okay, well, this is something I got to do alone. And then he charges off to the castle. It's just like, okay, well, that was not very Robin Hood. Because Robin Hood is about his gang of merry men and everything. He is about being that inspiring leader. And like Barker, and some of that's the writing and some of that's the performance, you know, whatever.
Yeah, and that was the story they were trying to do. It made it more dramatic for the pirates to turn around and come in and help him after all when he thought he was on his own and going to die. So I could see what they were trying to do with the film, but when we're rating him as one of our best Robin Hoods or not, I'm comfortable, like, as a presentation of Robin Hood, we can put him at the bottom.
Absolutely. Like I said, I kind of went back and forth. You know, I genuinely liked Russell Hicks better as a Robin Hood, despite yep. having very little screen time. I genuinely think he was better Robin Hood.
Yep. Yeah. No, like, as we said at the time, Bandit of Sherwood Forest would have been a much better film if it had been about old Robin Hood getting the gang back together and not about his son. And that includes if Russell Hicks was in that role. That role, that Robin Hood getting the gang back together, would have been a better movie.
Yeah, I would watch that movie.
Yeah, but that means we want to see more of him. Lex Barker, yeah, I don't care about seeing more of him.
Not done with him.
No, yeah.
All right, we've got our new Robin on the list. Full dozen Robins now. We've run through our questions. I think we've hit the high points. I think we've hit the low points. We've given our thoughts. Any closing words, Theo?
I'm just glad that when I eventually did get his parrot feathers.
Yeah, he did get his bird of paradise feathers.
Yeah.
Good for him. And he was like hugging them at the end.
Yeah. they're precious to him.
Yeah.
And I'm happy that he's happy. I hope he finds further happiness with Hook later.
Yeah.
And Sweet Pea, because that and they were setting that up as yeah. kind of a polycule, I'm just going to say.
You're right.
Yeah.
I support that poly pirate ship.
Yeah.
Oh, and they had a poly. Poly, you know.
Poly, possibly pan pirate ship?
Like I said, good shades of Our Flag Means Death there.
And yeah. and I say that now, and audience, understand, I am a huge fan of Our Flag Means Death, and we say this positively.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah, I would watch a movie about that crew about.
I think you did. I think it was called Our Flag Means Death,
right? But Sweet Pea and the Hook guy and that one guy that was like weirdly talking about people's dreams and things, very much again like a Our Flag Means Death character.
Yeah.
Right?
I forgot about like, that guy.
Yeah.
Our Flag Means Death is a remake of this movie confirmed, shot for shot.
Shot for Our Flag Means Death is a shot for shot remake of this movie, and weirdly so is the Kevin Costner Prince of Thieves.
Yep. Yes.
All right. Thank you so much, guys. Have a great evening. And thank you. Just for coming on. It's been a lot of fun.
Thanks for bringing me back in again. This was a lot of fun.
All right. Good night.
Good night. Good night. Feared by the bad, loved by the good, Robin Hood, Robin Hood, Robin Hood.
You're a motorcycle riding bro, cool dude.
Yeah, I worked on a bike today, man.
That's
I was I was drinking. Okay, it's not beer; it's hard cider. But
I was drinking a rosé, working on my bike,
watching Hell's Bells.